I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Coming up with the idea may be the easy part. Putting it to paper or computer screen is an entirely different challenge. And don't even get me started on writer's block. When you're a professional writer, finding the right words can mean the difference between getting paid or not. Today, we've gathered a group of well-known Kansas City-based writers to shed light on their process, from research to balancing writing with the demands of everyday life, from working with editors to negotiating with publishers. Our roundtable will reveal the trials and tribulations of the modern-day author. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Nathaniel Hawthorne once said, "Easy reading is damn hard writing." I'm guessing that writers around our table this morning might agree with that. Today, a writer's roundtable will be talking about the process of putting words down on a computer screen, combating writer's block, the importance of firsthand research, and how great writers go about plotting out books that sometimes span hundreds of pages. With us is Candace Millard. She's the author of a pair of bestsellers, Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President, about the death of James Garfield, and The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey. She lives in Leawood, and Candace, always good to have you here. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Linda Rodriguez is also here. She's the author of Every Broken Trust, A Mystery Just Out, and Every Last Secret, A Mystery. She lives in Kansas City. And Linda, nice to have you too.
Lovely to be
here. Good morning.
Steve.
David Vondrely writes for Time Magazine. He's the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year, and the book Triangle, an account of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. David, good to have you back too.
Great to be here, Steve.
I used to think, you know, that I was going to write a book someday, and maybe I will. But anymore, when I walk into Rainy Day Books or Barnes & Noble and I see all those books, sometimes I get the impression that the world might do pretty well without my contribution. So, Candace, and you know, for the three of you, why were you so convinced that you had to write the books you've written?
Well, you know, I think that you fall in love with a subject. That's what happened to me. I was working at National Geographic magazine, and I heard the story about Theodore Roosevelt taking a trip down an uncharted river in the Amazon in which three men die. Roosevelt nearly commits suicide, and it's, you know, set in the Amazon, so you have this opportunity to tell the story of this, the richest, most fascinating ecosystem on Earth. And I just, you know, felt that I had to tell the story. Now, the question of whether I could tell the story or anyone would want to hear the story was very different. But I just dove in and gave it my all and was surprised and thrilled to find that I could get an agent and publisher.
You know, David, here you are. You have kids. You know, you're writing for Time Magazine. And then you set off and you write this book on Abraham Lincoln in the year 1862. What were you thinking?
I don't know what I was thinking, Steve, when I set out
still
to do
trying it. To figure that
I
out,
was,
right?
I was thinking that I write books mainly because I get interested in the subject. Again, as Candace said, this is a way for me to study something and feel like I'm accomplishing. I have a purpose with it. And in the famous words of Samuel Johnson, also, it's a financial thing. None but a blockhead ever wrote but for money, said the great doctor. And so those kids were a factor as well. I tell young writers who are thinking about a first book, you have to love your idea, because there comes a time in my experience and many of my friends with any book when all you've got is your passion. You lose confidence in what you're doing and how you're doing it and your ability to get to the end. And if you don't like your subject at that point, you're lost.
I've heard you say that before. You've really got to be invested or you're in trouble. Linda, how about you? Why do you do what you do?
Well, I write fiction as well as poetry, and basically characters come and the people talk in my head, and I have to get it down on paper so that I won't be crazy.
It's a self-survival skill,
yes,
here, right?
It is. But yeah. I'll second, David. I would say further to writers, young writers, if you don't have to write, if you don't love writing so much, look for another position, because the full average full-time writer in America today makes about $10,000 a year.
Yeah.
And those of us who make slightly more have to count ourselves as really successful. So you've got to really love it to do it.
Well, speaking of that, Candace, you came into the studios today and you told me you're in phase two of your latest book about Winston Churchill. Your first phase is to research. Your second phase is to outline. Your third phase is to write. And you said you are just having a ball outlining your latest project, which that may might be good for you. That sounds like torture to me, but you sounded like you were just having a great time.
I love it. I mean, obviously, doing the research is a lot of fun. I mean, I I'm one of these people, and I'm sure everyone around this table is, who loves nothing more than to be in an archive or a library. But with my books, I often actually get to go to some really interesting places. This book I'm working on now is about Winston Churchill and the Boer War. So not only did I go to England and do research there, but I went to South Africa, right, mm-hmm. in December and spent a couple weeks there, and it was fascinating. But I have to say, and again, maybe this is I'm just estranged this way, but I was telling my husband, I can't believe that I'm actually paid to do this, because every day I drop my kids off at work and at school, and I go to work and I read and I read and I read and I read, and I'm surrounded by piles of documents and groaning shelves of books, and I organize it and I begin to outline. And to me, the outline is absolutely essential, especially for nonfiction, because you have to know where you're headed. And I do enjoy outlining, because I see the bones of the story begin to come together, and it's exciting to me.
And when you say you're outlining, are you doing it the way I learned in, I guess, elementary school, with the letter A and then number one and then subsection this and subsection that? Is that what you're doing?
Yes, I am. I mean, I obviously do it on
a
computer,
yeah.
You know, and but I do, you know, I have my different themes and things. Obviously, it's a chronological story, but I have all these sort of, sideline stories that will go in, and different characters, and I have to figure out where they go. And obviously, it changes dramatically through the year. And even after I begin to write, I'll realize, this story needs to go in a different chapter. So it changes a lot, and it moves around. But it is what you're picturing. It's an outline. It ends up being a huge outline, like 100 pages. And then when I'm ready to write, I'll take each chapter outline and just really fill it with all this detail.
You know, David, do you do the same thing? Because your latest book on Lincoln basically took the year 1862 month by month, which in some ways strikes me as kind of a self-survival kind of way to organize a book. It sort of organizes for you in some sense, which is not to minimize the task here at all. But was that part of the thinking in the way you went about that book?
I really only know how to tell stories from start to finish. I admire writers who are good with flashback, moving around in time. It's a very difficult technique, at least for me. And so I approach pretty much everything I do as either chronological in time or sequential in terms of logic, one idea leading to the next. I wish I could outline as Candace does, as my friend Rick Atkinson does. Great John McPhee is famous for his outlining. I can't get my stories quite that much into my head, and I tend to go sort of chapter by chapter. I know what's going to have to happen here, and I can see that far ahead. With the Lincoln book, ultimately, I wound up with index cards, 365 index cards, one for every day. And I could look at those. I'd say, you know, now we're going to do July, and look through, here's, remind myself of the material and say, okay, here's how we can, can hang on this string.
So you could do the index cards just month by month and sort of guide
your
way.
Yeah, I'd go sit down at the end of each month. That's as much of the book as I could get in my head at one time.
Because that's the challenge, right? In so many of these cases where you're looking at a book that spans 300, 400 pages, Robert Caro's cases with LBJ, books that span 700-800 pages, just the thought of that just buckles my knees. But if you can take it and break it down somehow, that makes a little more sense to me.
Well, what I learned from my first book, which is not very well put together, I would do it differently if I had it to do over, but it was a great learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered about writing a book is that it's a process of writing a page 500 times, basically. If you sit and you type long enough, eventually you'll have a book if you're ready to rework chapters and stuff like that. So I think all people looking at the finished product and thinking about writing a first book, it is very intimidating. How could I ever write that much?
Mm-hmm.
But it is a process of sitting down in a chair day after day and piling up the pages, and eventually you get a big enough pile.
Well, Linda Rodriguez, you're our fiction ambassador here this morning, and I'm wondering if the whole process of outlining applies to the work that you do and the mysteries that you put together.
Well, I have to outline to get myself started, because otherwise I'm too intimidated. It seems like too much. So I outline chapter by chapter and scene by scene, and that is the fun part. That's the part where it's all potential. But I'm just incapable of following a pattern or instructions. I have this little difficulty with authority, even my own. So I always veer away. And I've learned now that I will do that full outline, but I know within 50 pages I'll be changing. And by the time I get to the middle, I'll throw it out, and it'll be a different person who actually commits the murder and everything.
Oh, really? Well, is an outline essential, particularly for a mystery, given the fact that I'm sure there are some intricacies and some plot twists that you've got to be able to anticipate and sort of know where you're going, right?
You know, I usually have the end in mind, and I do wind up changing the murderer and motivation, all
really?
Kinds of stuff. And yet that ending scene winds up, when I wind up writing it, it winds up being very similar to what I had in mind. It often is different people, you know, but it winds up being the same scene.
That really surprises me that you don't have, you know, like the game of Clue, the place, the weapon, you know, Mr. Colonel Mustard in the billiard room. That changes? Because that makes me nervous, just thinking you're launching into a book that the key aspects of it might be flipping on you as you move along.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. It's absolutely true. And there are people who make detailed outlines and go by the outline. But there are a lot of people who don't do any outlines. They're called pantsers. They just go fly by the seat of their pants. You know.
And
I haven't got the courage to start the book without having the crutch of an outline and feeling like I know where it's going, even though after several now, I have learned that it's I'm not going to follow it. It's going to change. But I still need that to get myself going.
And once you have the outline, how much easier does that make the writing?
Writing is hard. I mean, you know, I love it. I'm like Candace. I'm just thrilled that I get to get paid to do what I love.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard work. I tell people who bitch about bad books out there, you know, even sitting down and typing a bad book from the book over written is a lot of hard work. It really is. Everybody is out there trying to do the best they can.
Yeah. Does the outlining make it, the writing, easier, Candace?
Much. For me, it makes it, just a world of difference, you know, because I know where I'm headed, and it gives me confidence. You know, I'm not just starting and thinking, my God, I mean, when you read a book and you think, well, that's the only way that story could be told, especially if it's nonfiction, you know, but that's not true. I mean, there are 1,000 different ways that you could tell that story.
Yeah.
And it is intimidating. And so if I've put that work in ahead. I have, here's my first chapter, and I know that these are the things I'm going to get in, and I usually stick in these quotes that I've found, and I know where I found them. And,
are those in your outline?
Yeah. Yeah, it's huge. And I also, you know, I have all these other files, you know, Word files on my computer, you know, that have like Winston Churchill on war, Winston Churchill's childhood, you know, Rudyard Kipling was there. What was he doing there? All these, you know, the Boers, the causes of the war, all these different files where I can quickly go and find it because, I mean, I'm sort of old-fashioned in that I do have, you know, drawers and drawers of files with a lot of my documents and things, but it's impossible to find them when you've spent, you know, more than a year gathering this stuff and you think, oh, I know I had that great quote or this really proves my point. Where did I put it? And I have it all organized now.
So you can find it.
I can find it, yeah. And it gives you confidence and you're excited to get writing. I mean, I'm not saying it absolutely is hard. And most days I finish thinking, God help me if anybody were to see what I just wrote. You know, it's horrible. Or I'll leave that day thinking, yeah, that's pretty good. And the next morning I come in and think, oh, my God.
Yeah, what is that?
You know,
what is that?
It's horrible. And so that's to me is fun, too. Then you get to edit it, you know, and you make it better and better. And you worry over, you know, what is the right adjective? And you think about it while you're doing laundry while you're sleeping. And you wake up in the morning, you're like, that's it. And I'll call myself or I'll write it on my phone or something so I don't forget I've solved some problem that I've been worrying about for weeks.
You know, what is it about writing? I find that if I write something and I feel good about it, invariably it's the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know, which is just, you know, isn't the way it should be. I guess I should feel bad about everything that I can't lose, I guess, right?
I agree. And I think often, you know, if I look at a sentence and think, you know, that is a beautiful sentence. That is really I need to get rid of it right away. You know, it's just too – I remember a friend reading someone's book and saying, that book was written. And, you know, that's not a compliment. You want it to tell a story and, you know, you hope it has nice rhythm and pacing and things. But if it seems too labored over, that's a problem.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're hosting a writer's roundtable talking about all different various aspects of writing, writing books, writing whatever. Candace Millard is here, Linda Rodriguez, David Vondrelli. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. How are book sales, generally speaking, across the country, David? Are books still selling pretty well? Are they not selling? Do you have any sort of overall sense of what's happening with the industry out there?
Candace's are selling great, and they should because they're wonderful. She's such a good storyteller.
Great story finder.
Actually, the business has been good, according to my publisher. Henry Holt had their best year ever last year.
Is that right?
The bookstore owners that I'm going to, particularly, interestingly, independent booksellers who have been complaining for a decade at least about their shoestring, all are reporting good years. They're doing better. I think they've figured out a lot about how to run their businesses, how to be more creative. Our Vivian Jennings at Rainy Day is one of the leaders in this area, Roger Doran. And so I'm hearing good things. I don't think, you know, reports of the death of the book are greatly exaggerated.
And when it comes to e-books and everything else, Linda, how is all that factoring into the book sales equation? And how do you feel about e-books these days?
Well, I love e-books. I make a lot of money off e-books, you know, though my favorite is still the paper book. I don't own an e-reader. You know, I'm a paper book person.
And you think the actual physical book is going to linger for a while to come?
Oh, yeah. People have been declaring the death of the book since the advent of movies, radio, television, DVRs, videotapes, the paperback book. And when the paperback book first came out, mass market paperback, they said this is the end of hardcovers. They sold more hardcovers last year than they ever have in the history of the publishing industry.
Is that right?
Yeah. And people tend to forget.
What is that? Why? Why is that?
Well, I think people like a book that they can hold, that's going to last, that they can, you know, and they're beautifully made, mm-hmm. you know. But people tend to forget with all the publicity that ebooks are really just a tiny fraction of the book market, that the paper books are still way, it's like 80%, and ebooks are around 20%.
One of the interesting trends that I've heard about is people will load books onto their e-readers, and then the ones they like, they'll mm-hmm. go and buy in the physical form for their shelf.
Yes.
That's terrific as well.
What sells more, fiction or nonfiction, just in general? Do you have any feel for that?
You know, I don't have a feel for that. I know where fiction sells really well, and I know what parts of the country are the big fiction buyers, and I know who buys books. Women buy books. Women are the book-buying public.
Yes.
Men don't buy books the way women do.
Really?
No, it's true. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that the editors and publishers will try to get you to write books with male protagonists and all, because women will buy books written by men with male protagonists. Men tend not to buy books written by women with female protagonists.
Well, that's interesting.
And it goes clear down to kids. So the young adult books, there's a big outcry now that we have to have more books for boys, because there are all these very successful young adult books with female protagonists, but boys won't read them.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number again. Mike from Waldo. Mike, you're joining our Writers Roundtable this morning. Good morning.
Yes, and I'm addressing this to Candace and the gentleman. As Candace was talking, doing all that research on Winston Churchill, and my question, you know, in order to not plagiarize, you've got to quote your source. And my question is, when you do research like that, it seems like everything you put in a book has to be acknowledged to somebody else. And my question is, what do you bring to the process? And do you understand my question?
Yeah, I do. I think you spend years researching and getting to know these characters, and you tell the story your way. I mean, there, you know, again, a thousand different ways you can tell a story, and so you see in it, you know, its richness, and I always say when as David was saying earlier, when you choose an idea, that is really the most important part of the process. You know, you have to make sure that you have an idea that has a great character, somebody you can come to know and care about and watch grow and change. And you have a story that's not just a subject, but is a story that you can follow. And then you can learn things along the way. But also, in nonfiction, you absolutely have to have a story that has a lot of primary source material. So you can have dialogue, so you can have all those little details that bring the story to life and bring the reader there to that time and that place. And hopefully that's what the writer does.
I'm just wondering, in your latest book on Churchill, you're going back fairly early in his life. I'm not mm-hmm. sure how much I want to say about it. But having said that, was there a lot of primary source material available for what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. And I'd be happy to say. So, again, it's about Winston Churchill and the Boer War. So he was only 24 years old at that time. He turned 25. He ended up being captured. He went there as a war correspondent, and he was captured and taken as a prisoner of war, and he turned 25 in this prison camp. But so he's only 25 years old. This is his fourth war he's been in, and he's already written two books and is working on his third. And so he's keeping diaries. He's writing letters. People are writing letters to him. Even from prison, he's writing letters.
And
he's
those sending have survived, out, obviously.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the Churchill archives in Cambridge are incredibly, incredibly rich. There's so much there. But actually, obviously, going to South Africa, I found a lot of his dispatches and beautiful things. Like I found, it was amazing, just by chance, I found this hand-drawn map of the Battle of Diamond Field that Churchill himself drew. Huh. It's just incredible. So it's really, really rich in primary source material, and you absolutely have to have that, or you can't tell the story. You certainly can't make it a page-turner.
You know, David, in your case, in the whole idea of tackling Lincoln, there have only been 84 trillion books written about Abraham Lincoln. What about that part of what you were taking on there in terms of trying to get your arms around all that material so you could do what you wanted to do there?
Well, in a way, it was liberating, Steve. I mean, if you go to Ford's Theater in Washington, they now have a display of where they've just simply piled up 15,000 Lincoln books in the atrium. So you can look at this mountain. And I read so slowly that in a way it was liberating. I knew that I could not possibly read everything that's been written about him or even read everything coming out about him to stay current. So that I chose and I found the biographies that I thought were the best and dug deeply into those and then went right on to the original source material. And same way with the Civil War. I found a couple of really great books, including one by a Kansas City author, Herman Hadaway, with Archer Jones, Why the North Won is the best one-volume military history of the war.
Wow.
And I relied heavily on those and then immediately went into the original material.
Yeah. How about researching fiction work, Linda? How do you do much, and how do you do it, and what do you do?
Well, my Skeet novels, my mystery series with Skeet Banyan, is set in and around Kansas City. And I have a small town right outside of Kansas City that I've based sort of on Parkville and a little bit on Liberty and a few other small towns. And, you know, and I go there to refresh my memory on a lot of these things. I'm also in the midst of doing a historical novel that's set in Tahlequah with the Cherokee Indians, because awesome. I'm part Cherokee, after the Trail of Tears, because nobody has ever written about after the Trail of Tears, when they completely rebuilt and had a newspaper within 2 years, though they were destitute when they landed. And there was tremendous conflict, and it takes them all the way through the Civil War because the tribe was ripped apart by the Civil War.
Hmm. Sounds great. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our writer's roundtable here with Candace Millard, Linda Rodriguez, David Vondrelli. We'll talk about publishers, editors, and solitude, the whole lonely process of actually writing a book. We'll take your phone calls, too, 816-235-2888. And again, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about Truman's integration of the military, you can find it in the latest installment of 90 Mile View. It's at kcur.org. After 17 years, the Kansas City Ballet's artistic director is taking his last curtain call here in town. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with him and check in with a newly anointed James Beard award-winning chef. That's in our weekend to-do list tomorrow. On the show this hour, we're hosting a writer's roundtable. We're visiting with Candace Millard, Linda Rodriguez, David Vondrelli about the process of writing, the pain of writing a great book. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. And again, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Bob from Fairway. Good morning, Bob.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had two questions for the writer's panel,
sir.
To maybe deal with, and one is pretty simple. It's like when you're not a writer, when you're not getting paid, how do you what are some of the ideas about breaking into the field, struggling, and all of
right.
that? And then the second question was I believe it was on Central Standard. They had a psychologist, and they talked that the doctor actually mentioned how being an artist or a writer is a lonesome profession, and that normal people would quote, normal people would be compelled to want to be with someone. And is it, you know, what are some of the ways that you can deal with the loneliness and the isolation of being a writer?
Right. Bob, those are great questions. You know, Kafka once said that writing is utter solitude, the descent into the cold abyss of oneself. Linda, how do you deal with the solitude of writing?
Well, I write fiction. For me, it's not a solitary pursuit. I have all these people in my head that are, you know, that I've created, and I'm listening to them and I'm watching them. A lot of times when I'm writing, I'm up walking around. I'm, you know, trying to act out things in the scenes to see how people would actually be situated for them. I love my time alone. I like people, but when I go too long without time alone, when I can write, I get really grumpy.
You got to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah. David, how about you? This whole idea of solitude and sort of having to get away to do what you do.
Well, it's absolutely necessary, number one. It has to be done. What I don't understand is how people collaborate on books.
Yes.
Because I can't really express frequently where I'm going or tell people. And so folks that are working together amaze me. But a professor in college, the best lesson I ever learned about writing was a philosophy professor explained to me through a long summer of work that the key to writing is thinking. And until you think clearly about what you have to say, it doesn't matter how flowery or how many words you know or how good you are at turning a sentence, you can't write well. And thinking through difficult problems is a very solitary experience.
You know, I know enough about you to know that at one point in the writing of the Lincoln book, you actually had to sort of break away from the homestead and sort of get your own place to do your writing. Tell us about that and why that was important for you.
It's basically, you know, I'm reluctant to over-dramatize how hard writing is. You know, it's a lot easier than tons of jobs. You know, there's no heavy lifting. You're never going to end up on disability from having written. It's just the only muscles you need are in your rear end. You need blocks of time, blocks mm-hmm. of uninterrupted time. And I have four kids, but I'm not going to blame them for the interruptions of trying to work at home. It's me having, you know, the grass needs to be mowed, or I should go pull those weeds, or I wonder what's in the refrigerator, or, you know, let me go fold some clothes. There's always excuses, and the excuses are the enemy of a writer, I think. Colleagues would agree.
Mm-hmm. You know, Candace, when David was talking about writing, you were nodding, talking about thinking, you were nodding your head vigorously. Tell us about that, thinking and sort of thinking through what you're trying to do. And I guess through the outlining work you do, you've sort of explained you've got to think through it pretty clearly, at least in your case.
Well, and I think that a lot of writing is just having patience, too. It's, again, you know, looking for and waiting for that right subject. And then not just jumping into the writing. You know, you do absolutely. You have to really give it some thought, how you're going to tell the story. And getting to know these characters. I mean, going back to the, you know, being a solitary pursuit. I mean, my characters, obviously, I didn't make them up. They didn't come from my head. But I get to know them. In fact, you know, you spend so much time with them that when my book is finished, I miss them.
I've heard others say that.
Spending time with them. So it doesn't seem lonely at all. But absolutely a lot of the process. I mean, you know, I can go into work and spend hours and hours and leave not having written a word, or at least a word that I'm actually going to keep. But I've made a lot of progress simply thinking about it and working through and knowing how I'm not going to do it. And when I go home, you know, I'm doing laundry and making dinner and with the kids, and it's I'm still working on it. You know, it's something very, very true about the process of latent learning. Just like, you know, if you're learning piano or whatever it is, dance, anything, you stop. And or languages, you stop and you step away from it and your mind continues to work on it, definitely when you're sleeping. And it's amazing how those problems get solved and you're moving forward. And so I think that a mistake that a lot of writers make is being over-eager to start writing. I just need to start writing. Well, yeah, I mean, you can put something down on the page, but don't think that that's going to be your finished product, because it probably won't be and it probably shouldn't be. It's just a lot of thought and time that goes into it.
It's such an interesting idea to me that these characters are so real to you that you feel you're living with them and you don't feel alone. I think I've heard Doris Kearns Goodwin talk about this idea of once the book ends, she sort of misses people. And mm-hmm. Linda, you were nodding your head also. These people are so real to you that you feel you're living with them in a sense when you're writing your books.
Oh, yeah. And I get attached to them. In my first novel, I had one character that from the beginning was supposed to be the murderer, and he is a no-goodnik, but he's a charming no-goodnik, and I really like him, and I just decided, no, I don't want to make him the murderer because I want to keep him around. So somebody else had to do the murder, you know, and he's still there being a no-goodnik throughout the series.
I should point out that the official launch for Linda Rodriguez's Every Broken Trust, her latest book, will be at 6:30 Friday evening at Mysteryscape, a bookstore, 7309 West 80th Street in Overland Park, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Brad from Prairie Village. Brad, good morning.
Okay. The first question is, how do you keep the facts from getting in the way of a good story?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah.
Then the second one is, we've had wizards and vampires and kinky behavior. What's the next big trend in big-selling books?
That's a great question, Brad. Yeah, who wants to tackle either one of those?
I wish I knew.
we could corroborate on that book, couldn't we? Yeah,
I can talk about the second one.
Yeah, wizards, kinky behavior,
yes,
what's the next
yes.
trend? Yeah.
Right now, young adult is the hottest trend in fiction, and it part of because it's become wide open. You know, when I wrote my first novel, my first Skeet Banion mystery novel, at the end of it, I had I had two people shooting the villain at the same time, so that you didn't know which one of them actually killed him, and neither of them actually knew which one of them actually killed him, and one of them was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
and they made me change that ending because they said, we can't have a teenager doing this. And then right after that, the Hunger Games came out with young children, you know, on television, hunting and killing each other for the sport of people. And, you know, I said, what's with this? Well, young adult has no limits anymore. Sex is allowed. Violence is allowed. The death of children is allowed. And they don't have the genre limits. I mean, they toss it all in together, so writers are able to cross genres, and you have paranormal, mystery that's hard-boiled, and romance all in the same book. And the readers are just eating that up with spoon, and the vast majority of the people who are buying and reading young adult now are over 30.
Hmm.
So that's a big area. There's a new area that they've just became official because now it's listed in Publishers Marketplace for deals. It's called NA, which is new adult, and they're trying to piggyback on the young adult thing. And this is for people who are not, the protagonists are not teenagers. They're in their early 20s to maybe as old as 28,
mm-hmm.
and they're just getting started in their lives, and they're hoping to piggyback on that.
You know, Candace, when Brad asks us about this idea of facts getting in the way of a good story, I'm guessing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, that if the facts do get in the way of a good story, you won't tell that story. That's not where you're headed in what you're trying to do.
Well, I think the key word is story, and it's what I was saying earlier about when you are choosing what you're going to write about with nonfiction, not choosing a subject, but choosing a story. Because if you have a good story, you know, that's an engine that can pull a lot of weight as far as facts and different details that you hope the reader can learn something along the way. Like when I was writing about Theodore Roosevelt and the Amazon, I have a lot of natural history in that book, but it all comes out of the story. For instance, you're thinking, you know, how is it possible Theodore Roosevelt, this famous hunter, he and his men are dying of starvation in the richest ecosystem on Earth. How is that possible? And so you have to understand, you know, evolution, you know, that everything in this rainforest is much better at either not being prey or being a predator than these men are. So that I think it all has to rise organically out of the story. And so you hope that the reader is just so engrossed in the story and they want to understand, they want these questions answered, that it won't seem like hard work, you know, getting all this extra information. And Linda and I were talking about this earlier. Unfortunately, I think that's why a lot of children think history is boring or dry, because they're just, people are just throwing these dates at them or these names.
Yeah, what
but
a shame.
It's not. It's fascinating because there's so many incredible, unbelievable stories. I'm reading Rise to Greatness right now, and it is absolutely engrossing. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's moving.
Yes,
it's
yes,
fascinating.
It's all of that.
Yeah, it is.
That's David Von Drehley's latest book.
That's David
Von
Drehley's book. And, you know, I was thinking about also just talking about the young adult literature. It is huge in fiction right now. But as a parent with a child who's almost 11, I'm frustrated that there's not much nonfiction young adult.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I, you know, my daughter went to hear David Von Drehley give his talk at the Plaza Library, and she was so excited and she was so interested. And so I was going to talk to him about making a young adult version. But there are, you know, the Manhunt, the book Manhunt. There's Chasing Lincoln's Killer. It's a young adult
terrific
version.
Terrific book. And he's been in here, by the way.
Yeah. And the book Mayflower, Nathaniel Philbrick.
Yes.
There's a young adult version. So I'm hoping there will be more of that, because I think when you're an adult and you read a nonfiction book, you don't read it with the eyes of a parent or somebody who would think about a child. Sometimes there's violence or sexual content that you wouldn't want an 11-year-old to see, but the basic story would be great, because my daughter, she's like, I just want a good story, and she should be able to have that.
You know, as you're writing your book, David, and you're spending all these hours on it, how do you know if you've got it? How do you know if it's good enough? And how much of that doubt sort of lingers in your noggin as you're sort of tooling along with the whole thing?
Wow, that's a good question. I never know if anything I've written, whether it's a book or a Time magazine story or an email to a friend, is really good until after it's gone and I've had some time. I go back to it. I mentioned my first book, which was A History of Capital Punishment in Florida, and I thought it was great when it was done. I love that book, and I can't read it now. not that I spend all my time sitting around reading my books. My book on the Triangle Fire, which has been well received, I've been gratified by that, but I see all sorts of things in it I would change. And I assume in a few years when I go to the Lincoln book, I'll see things that I wish I'd done differently.
Yeah, but at what point in the process are you get some sense from an independent
that
source that you've got it? I mean, is your wife Karen reading it? Is your editor reading it?
I mean, my wife is a writer herself and is a great responder. I think all of us have friends, loved ones that we trust for maybe not everything, but for, I mean, I have a go-to friend that I count on to tell me my book is better than it is. You know, I'll send it and say, you know, how is this? And she will overreact and say, this is the greatest thing ever. And I only send stuff to her when I need that push. And then there's other people who will, I can count on to say, this doesn't work. You got to fix X or Y. And if you show them your stuff at the wrong moment, you know, they'll kill you. So knowing that kind of thing. The other thought I had about one of our earlier callers asked, how do you get started? And when Candace was talking about her process, it really struck me. The way to start as a writer is reading, not writing. Mm-hmm. But you read as a professional instead of as an amateur. You're not reading for fun anymore. But if for example, the caller wants to know, how do you not let the facts get in the way of a good story? The answer to that is in Candace's books. You know, read her books, take them apart, and you will see how a master leverages the facts to the story.
Mm-hmm.
You take it apart. The great nature writer Annie Dillard once told me that when she teaches classes, she talks about an art teacher she once knew. A kid came up to him and said, I want to be a painter. What does it take to be a painter? And the guy said, I don't know. Do you like the smell of paint? It's the same thing for a writer. You want to be a writer? Do you like sentences? Because that's what books are made out of, is sentences. Do you like words? Do you like figuring out how people who are good at putting them together do it? Mm-hmm. Linda, I'm sure you've gone to Stephen King, or you've gone to there are super writers in your genre, and you've taken those books apart, I bet.
Absolutely, and that's what I always tell students to do. Learn to read as a writer. Find someone who's really good at transitions. Go through and buy the books so you can mark them up.
How do you know when what you've written is good enough? Do you have someone who's reading it, a buddy who's reading it as you go along, or how do you know?
I am blessed. I am married to a wonderful, wonderful editor. He runs Bookmark Press here at UMKC, Ben Furnish. And he's my first reader. I don't like to let anybody see my work till I've revised and revised and revised.
Sure.
And when I'm ready to send it out, I have Ben read it first, because he will put his finger on anything that seems weak, and I'll be able to fix that, and then I'll send it out. I've got some critique partners then who might see it. I'll send it to my agent, but he's my first reader.
Do you have a sixth sense as you're moving along, Linda, that what you're writing, you feel good about it, you have a certain confidence, or are you sort of lost as you go along and really not know where this thing sort of fits on the quality scale?
I always veer back and forth, you know.
Yeah.
The thing
I can only
is,
imagine.
I look at it and it's like, as long as I can see something that needs to be fixed, I work on it. I'm a just compulsive reviser. When I can't see anything to fix, even if I'm not entirely happy with it, that's when I turn to other people.
Yeah, okay. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to a Writer's Roundtable. Our guests, Candace Millard, Linda Rodriguez, David Von Drayley. Let's go to Cheryl from Independence. Cheryl, thanks for holding on. Good morning.
Well, thank you, and good morning to you all. I wanted to point out to Ms. Millard, there is a splendid website of interesting nonfiction for kids with such people as Jim Murphy, who has written a splendid long nonfiction book about the Blizzard of 1888, another about the Chicago Fire of 1871. Deb Heiligman has written a very highly regarded book for young readers about Charles and Emma Darwin. It's called Charles and Emma.
My daughter has that.
Yeah,
I
it's
just
a
got that
wonderful
for her. She
book.
Loves it. Yes.
And the Geographic published a social history biography of the tragic tale of Narcissa Whitman and a faithful history of the Oregon Trail.
Hmm.
There are some splendid things, and especially as the core knowledge standards are being implemented in the schools, that educators are craving good nonfiction, and there's a wealth of it to be had.
What is that website?
Yeah.
It's called Interesting Nonfiction for Kids. It's a group
Perfect.
Website where such people as Jan Greenberg of Missouri writes about artists. Melissa Stewart and Vicki Cobb write on science issues.
Hmm.
And so it's a very good resource.
InterestingNonfictionForKids.com, I gather, Cheryl?
Yeah, I think so.
Google it.
I think it's inkrethink.blogspot.com. But you can also find it on Facebook, Interesting Nonfiction for Kids, and that'll take you there.
That's awesome. Thank
right.
you.
Thank
yeah,
you very
thank
much.
Thank you all for what you do.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Diane from Parkville. Diane, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Oh, good morning,
Hi.
Steve. It's Diana Landon-Meyer. I've been a guest on your show.
Sure, Diane.
Yeah, author of Myths and Mysteries of Kansas and other things. And I learned so much from the late Shipper Stein about the creative process. And she always told me, and this works for me so well, if I'm hitting writer's block or I'm not happy with some of my word choices and sentences, to get away with it and do something that that inspires my senses. Go bake a cake and smell the baking cake. Or I'm a quilter. I love to sew. So I play with the fabrics. I explore the textures and the colors and everything. And by expanding my senses, my five senses, I can then come back to my desk and find myself so much more refreshed and so much more creative. So that's just something I wanted to throw into the conversation and see if any of your other guests have had similar experiences in that regard.
Yeah, Diane, thank you. And the answer to your question is yes. Linda Rodriguez talks about the whole idea of sparking creativity when the well runs dry on her website. You do something very similar to what Diane does, I think.
Yes. Walking is always big. Charles Dickens is maybe the most famous of authors who took long walks to spark his creativity.
How did he have time to walk and write all those books?
You know, and he was
without
he
a computer.
Acted in plays, and he was the Victorians were just, they were a different species from the rest of us.
Yeah.
But I'm a fiber artist, and I do, I spin yarn and knit and weave and quilt. You know, do small art quilts, and I find that helps. But it's the same thing if you draw or use glitter, whatever you want to do. Do something creative that doesn't involve words.
Just quickly, in the minute we have left here, agents, publishers, editors. Editors are your friend, David, or not? Or
yeah, all good writers like editors. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a myth that we fight our editors. We dream of good editors. And we value them. We cling to them.
Candace?
Absolutely. And I will say that I really think you need an agent, too, just speaking to those.
But they're hard to get these days, aren't they?
I know. But you know what? You get the writers, what is it, Writers Marketplace 2013. There's just go on, you know, any website or go to any bookstore and you can find it. And it has every single agent out there and it shows you who they represent. So if they represent the type of writers that you want to be and just start sending out those letters, you know, and have a thick skin and pick yourself up and keep sending them out if you get rejections. You know, if you're good and you're devoted, it'll happen. It really will.
Well, I want to thank Candace Millard, Linda Rodriguez, David Von Ridley. What a great conversation. Thank you all for coming in and chatting today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having us, Steve.
More information about our broadcast, just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. After 17 years, the Kansas City Ballet's artistic director is taking his last curtain call here in town. Tomorrow on the program, we'll talk with him, and we'll check in with a James Beard Award-winning chef, Colby Geraltz, and hear our weekend to-do list. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.